Welcome to NuclearCast, the official podcast of the Amrod Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Loudville, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amrod Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NuclearCast. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, and today I have with me Major General Stacy Huser, who is the 20th Air Force Commander. Of course, she leads all of those wonderful missileers, maintenance officers, you know, the missile maintainers, the cops that are out in the nuclear field, you know, the support staff, and of course, she is speaking to us from the great white north of Cheyenne, Wyoming, and F.E. Warren Air Force Base, which, you know, if you spent much time, missileers know this, but, you know, it's you get used to colder weather, except when you go down to Barksdale Air Force Base for a staff tour. Otherwise, you know, you can spend most of your career up north. Stacy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And one of the things that we tell people is Cheyenne is our southernmost missile base. So we don't even call it our northern tier, even though it's most definitely the northern tier.
That's a good point, right? Who would have ever thought Cheyenne, Wyoming would be the sunny, warm south? But yes, for missileers, it certainly is. So let's start off. We've talked, you know, to General Armagost at 8th Air Force. We've talked to lots of folks at, you know, we talked the last time we talked to you, you were at NNSA. So we understand the DOE. We understand the bomber leg of the triad, but we've never really talked about 20th Air Force and the ICBM leg. So could you give us, you know, a brief history of 20th Air Force and then just tell us what capabilities does 20th have? Who are you? Where are you? What are you doing?
Definitely. Well, 20th Air Force, we just celebrated our 80th anniversary of 20th Air Force in April. So that was very exciting. So our roots go back to the B-29 bombardment squadrons, groups, and wings from World War II, which is incredible. But now our mission is everything ICBM. So we have three ICBM intercontinental ballistic missile wings located here at Cheyenne, Wyoming. So we have F.E. Warren Air Force Base here. We have Minot Air Force Base in Minot, North Dakota. So we have a missile wing up there, and then they share that base with one of the bomb wings. And then we have Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls, Montana. And then we have a fourth wing located at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So our ICBM wings are spread across five different states, and then we have folks in New Mexico, which is pretty awesome.
So tell us about the capabilities that you field, and give our listeners, you know, who might not be missileers, you know, maybe they're DOE scientists or they're, you know, civilians working at SAIC or Booz Allen in DC. Create a mental image of the missile field, these squadrons, these wings. You know, what does it take to run a missile squadron and maintain it and ensure that Minuteman III, which is older than me, it's older than you, I'm sure as well. But so they're getting up there. Tell us about that.
Awesome. Thank you. So at each of our three missile wings, we have 150 launch facilities where an intercontinental ballistic missile would be housed. And these launch facilities are not near the base. They are spread out from the base hundreds of miles. And then there are missileers, maintainers, defenders who travel hundreds of miles to monitor, sustain, maintain, defend these launch facilities. So every day we have people driving across these states, hundreds of miles, sometimes several hours, to do their jobs. And one thing that's unique about our ICBM force is it is always generated to alert. It is always ready to go. There's no period of time that we need, no hours or days to generate this force to alert. It is always ready should the president want to execute that option. And the missileers are out there watching their missiles, ensuring that they're defended as needed, ensuring that if there's any faults, that those are fixed promptly. And if they should need to, they're ready to execute.
So when we think about a Minuteman III, and these, you know, these are 50-year-old weapons, and we think about, you know, for many people, they just sort of take for granted and they say, oh, well, they've been sitting in silos, so they're fine. You know, they're protected. There's, you know, they're not exposed to the elements. And so don't, you know, it's all good. Create a mental image for us of what it is to maintain and operate a weapon that is that old. And tell us, you know, because historically we would replace our nuclear delivery vehicles every 10 to 15 years. And that was what we planned with Minuteman. But now they're 50 years old. What's that like?
Exactly. So the Minuteman III was designed with a 10-year service life. And just as you pointed out, they've been out there for well over 50 years now. And we've done things over the years to change out different parts of these systems, to upgrade different parts, to upgrade the command and control of these systems, upgrade the way we talk to them, upgrade the way they're maintained and sustained. We've upgraded different parts of their security features so that way they're easier to keep secure, easier to defend. You don't need as many humans to do it because you've upgraded so many of the physical features or the comm features of them. But they are aging as expected. Obviously, they're over 50 years old, so they have aged very, very well. But they are aging nonetheless. And there are different pieces of equipment that are corroding now, for example, that nobody anticipated they would corrode, but they didn't also anticipate them being out there for as long as they have been. And these parts, of course, are not easy to reproduce. They're not easy to acquire. A lot of these are niche parts that maybe somebody made them back in the day and they were making hundreds and hundreds, but now perhaps we only need five. And so what company just wants to make a handful of parts that have these very strict requirements? So all of these challenges are arising and have been arising for many years. We're super lucky because we have a lot of mission partners that help us with all of these challenges. We have the Air Force Nuke Weapons Center, which is our main program office that helps. We also have Global Strike Command, where our leadership and advocates are located. And then other, of course, you know, contracting labs, different partners all around the United States.
So I want to think back, you know, I spent a lot of time, a lot of fond memories with missileers. And, you know, as we think about from the time that the Cold War ended and, you know, the ICBM force spent time at different commands, and then ultimately in 2009, because we took our eye off the ball, and then in 2009, we get the stand up of Global Strike Command. And then there was this refocus on the nuclear mission. And then it took us some time because, you know, the missile field sort of had this, you know, pyramid in which you have a lot of missileers come in, do their missile time. Then they go out into different, you know, AFSCs because you didn't need all of those missileers. And then now we've, you know, fixed the career path of missileers. If we have some listeners who were, let's say they retired 10, 15, 20 years ago, and that they haven't been exposed to this sort of new approach, can you talk to us about how we have made the missile career path an attractive, successful place for, you know, the Air Force's best and brightest to be?
Yes. So first, I'll tell a little bit how it's different now if somebody's been away from for a while or is unaware. So you're right. We assess in a lot of missileers because we need a lot to perform that that duty where they're out in the missile field. You need hundreds and hundreds of them to do that. And then it was for a while a very steep pyramid. We let a lot of those after their first assignment, so after their first about 4 to 5 years in the military, we would let them go off and become members of other career fields, and we would never get them back. So after we had some different instances where we feel like we weren't really paying attention to the nuclear enterprise, we changed our model. And so now, for the most part, once you're a missileer, you're always a missileer. You're a missileer for the rest of your career. And we've done a couple things because of that. So now a missileer will do their first assignment for 3 years at one missile base, and then they will do a second 3-year tour, either at the same base or at one of the other two missile bases. And that's where they'll kind of graduate to an instructor, an evaluator, ultimately a flight commander, maybe an executive officer. And then after that 6 years, they will leave the missile base, but they will still be a missileer. So they will go to other jobs around the country that need missileers, like U.S. STRATCOM or Air Force Global Strike Command, Joint Staff, places like that, or they'll go to some type of specialized school. So we have done that, which has been incredible. The other thing that we've done is, because once you're a missileer, you're always a missileer, when they do come back to those missile bases, in the past, leaders at the missile bases were not performing alerts. They weren't pulling what we call pulling alerts out in the field. So your squadron commanders, group commanders, wing commanders weren't, I guess you could say, weren't doing the mission, though I'm sure they felt like they were 100% busy in doing the mission. But they weren't pulling alerts. So now everybody pulls alerts, which is a great change. And I think, you know, it mirrors what is done in the pilot community, because flyers always need to fly to maintain their currency. Well, now missileers always need to pull alert. And we even have missileers who are here at 20th Air Force on the staff, or down at Global Strike Command on the staff, who will travel out to the missile wings and maintain their currency on alert. So it's a very good change. Standing up of Global Strike Command was great for our community. So now we have a command that is focused on nuclear. And then we have 20th Air Force, where I am, the numbered Air Force, that is focused on all things ICBM. So all day, every day, all we think about are ICBMs.
So one of the things that was, as I got familiar with the missileer community, and the challenge for missileers has always been having opportunities to lead, because a missile squadron, you know, you're a lieutenant colonel, you're a missile squadron commander, you've got 56 officers. And so as opposed to, let's say, you're an army officer who's led at the platoon and the company, and you've had opportunities to grow over time. Are there initiatives, things that you're doing to help give missileers opportunities to lead sort of at a younger age, to and build that skill and understanding and experience that, you know, I'm drawing a blank all of a sudden. Clausewitz, you know, he talked about Fingerspitzengefühl, that fingertip feel for how to use and employ, you know, troops in battle. Are you teaching missileers to have that Fingerspitzengefühl for leadership? And what are y'all doing to make that happen?
Well, one of the things that we realized in 2014, when we had the incident at Malmstrom with the cheating, one of the things we realized is we had elevated decision-making and leadership at this weirdly abnormally high level. So we had flight commanders back then, but the flight commanders weren't allowed to be flight commanders. We had stripped that away, and essentially at most of the wings, your wing commander or group commander were making decisions that should have been made by captain flight commanders. So one of the things that I probably love the most in our community is, over the past 10 years, we have pushed decision-making and true leadership, true authority and responsibility, down to where it is supposed to be at the right level. So flight commanders now are making those flight commander decisions. The other thing we've done is they added assistant director of operations to every missile squadron. So then that's an opportunity for a senior captain, a junior major, to lead at that intermediate level between your missileers and your squadron leadership. So that provides them some opportunities. And then one thing that a lot of even people within our own community don't realize, and we're trying to do a better job of educating them, is there are a lot of opportunities outside of the nuclear enterprise or at different places within the nuclear enterprise where you can grow and develop that aren't at a missile wing. They can go to United States Strategic Command. We have an amazing woman who's currently working at the Department of State. I got to go to the Department of Energy. And then we have different schools that folks can go to. They could be a ROTC instructor and get development and leadership opportunities that way. There's just a lot of things that people can go do. Defense Threat Reduction Agency. Like there's just so many. But we need to make sure that we're telling that story so that way they know that, you know, they're not just going to be at three bases their whole lives, that we are going to send them other places so that way they're properly developed and get a host of experiences, because that's so important.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. So 2014, 2015, we have the Force Improvement Program. We implement all of these changes. And now, you know, you were a field grade officer at the time, and now you're back in charge. You know, it's a decade later. What, if you were to look back over that last 10 years to see what's different today than was then, you know, good or bad, what would you look back and say about that, you know, this sort of period of change?
I would say the good things are the increased leadership responsibilities, the fact that we're not assessing in a bunch of people just to give them all away. You know, we were giving away a lot of our best and brightest. Now we're keeping them. I mean, there's, of course, always people that we are going to let go for different reasons, and that's a squadron commander, group commander's decision, but we keep a lot. Another thing that is, it probably sounds minor, but it really had an effect on our career field, is we used to lament the number of alerts you had. If you had a lot of alerts out in the missile field, it's because you were not one of the best. You were not pulled out to be an instructor or an evaluator. You were stuck in the missile field, just pulling alerts. And now that has completely flipped 180 degrees. Now it's celebrated how many alerts you have. And up at Minot, we had a board with the people's names who had the highest number of alerts. And we would have a celebration like once a month and change the names on the board and just celebrate, you know, someone who had over 300 alerts. And then back in the day, that did not happen at all. So a lot of goodness, a lot of great changes. I would say for, you know, it's been 10 years, but we are still learning what the right mix is of instruction and evaluation and inspection, and what is enough, what is too much, what is the right amount. So we're constantly changing and evolving. A lot of people think, you know, ICBMs, they've been around a long time. We're stuck in our ways. We're, you know, black and white checklist discipline. We can't change. But the business of ICBMs is actually changing all the time. We are constantly looking at how we do testing, how we do training, how we do evaluation, how we do our tactics, techniques, and procedures. And we're constantly evolving those to make sure that, you know, we're taking good care of our system, we're doing the right things for our nation and the American public, and we're also doing the right things for the people who are doing the business and not putting undue pressures on them, or expecting more than should be expected of somebody doing this job. We don't want to expect perfection, because that's what drove some bad behaviors. We want to expect excellence in working together.
Yeah, I don't know if many Americans sort of fundamentally realize that when we have young, you know, second lieutenants, first lieutenants, captains, pulling alert, and compare that to the Soviet system, where you would have colonels pulling alert because they didn't trust their young officers to, you know, turn keys on an ICBM, whereas we trust much younger people to do that mission. So all of these things that you're saying is, it's really very important for us to develop this career for, you know, this career force, these, and to do it with, you know, weapons that are, you know, like we said, 50 years old. And it's a, certainly a, and you're doing it in a challenging environment. You know, I was at FE talking, you know, doing some staff work many moons ago. And the big problem then was, you know, driving Humvees on icy roads led to rollovers. And so you know, if you have to drive 100 miles in the winter in Montana or North Dakota in a Humvee, because Humvees are not necessarily, you know, ideal for icy roads. And then, you know, your cops might be, they might, you know, slide off the road. And so you operate in these very challenging environments. If you think back to just being a missileer and now leading 20th Air Force, what would you say for you are those things that when you stepped into the job, because you've been in the job less than a year now, I think it's been, yeah, it's been less than a year. So, and you said, you know, maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago, if I ever am in charge of 20th Air Force, I'm going to, what were those things that you were telling yourself you were going to do?
Oh, man. So first of all, you nailed it with the young people. So we've got, you know, young, you know, 20-year-olds who are defending these nuclear assets. You've got young 20-year-olds who are maintaining these nuclear assets. And they are so smart and so motivated and so incredibly talented at their jobs that it is awesome. So me coming in, you know, I'm a super touchy feely person. So some of the things I wanted to do were just increase transparency with people, especially our leaders. A lot of times we talk about taking care of airmen, but you've got to care for the caregivers a lot of the times. So making sure that our senior leaders, our squadron commanders, our group commanders, our wing commanders are being cared for and listened to, and that their families are being cared for, and that we're telling them what our plans are for them, that we're listening to them. I warn people that I'm not an idea generator. I'm just not that creative, but I can be the best cheerleader that they've ever had. So being open to new ideas from the force, and then giving that idea everything I have to advocate for it, resources, fight whoever I need to fight to make sure it's implemented. Because our folks have great ideas and they know best. They know best how to take care of this system, how to defend the system, and how to operate the system, because they're doing it every day. So if they come up and say, hey, we could do this better if, then I'm all about making sure that if happens and doing what I can to do that.
So in the couple years that you're going to have at 20th Air Force, as you look at it and you've been in the seat now, are there specific things that you say, hey, I want to make this change. I want this to be different when I walk out the door. Here's how I'm going to improve, you know, the missile career force, the wings. Here's how I'm going to prepare for, you know, Sentinel to get here. What are those things?
A lot of them are some of the things that we've talked about, like Minuteman III is old and it gets harder to sustain that system every year. We're doing it, but it's harder and it takes more hours and more effort from the same number of people. We're not getting more people to sustain this aging weapon system. So what can I do to advocate for us to get more defenders? And General Bussier is very, very passionate about fighting for filling. We have a lot of defender billets that currently are unfilled. So he's very, very strong in advocating for those defender billets. What additional maintainers do we need in order to do this? What staff members do we need in order to advocate for that? So if I could pick one thing, it would be to get the right manning in place So that way we can maintain and sustain this weapon system at the highest levels and ensure that it's on alert. It has, our ICBM force has an incredible alert rate. It is in the high 90s, but it is on the backs of airmen and civilians that they're keeping it at that high alert rate.
Yeah, you sort of spur two points. And the first one is, let's suppose hypothetically there's a problem with a missile out at some launch facility. You may require, and this could be, you know, any month of the year, you may have to have cops that are out there, you know, at some LF in the middle of some field somewhere in a camper 24/7 watching that field while, or watching that missile while, you know, maintenance or repairs or whatever are taking place. And so you got to have, you know, these security forces out there doing that mission. So this is why numbers matters. And the older things are, the more problems you have, the more, you know, manpower. So it's a fair point. And then you mentioned operational readiness rates. And I just came across a number that I hadn't really paid it much attention to, but F-35 operational readiness rates. And they're at about 48% right now, which, you know, for the U.S. Air Force, it's usually for aircraft, it's, you try to keep it above 80-90%. And so with a new system like F-35, we're at 48. And so with a very old system like Minuteman, you're keeping it into the high 90s. So that's, you know, that's one of those pat on the back to the missile community kind of things. So congratulations to everybody for making that happen. And most Americans take that for granted. That, you know, missiles are on alert and they're defending the nation, and our adversaries know and understand in minutes we can launch those weapons, and, you know, we'll ruin a lot of folks' day. So that's important. Okay. Now it's that time where I bring out Bob the Genie, rub my magic lamp, and you get three wishes about the topics we've been discussing. Bob doesn't grant youth or fame or fortune or money or anything like that, but he does grant wishes about missiles. So, Stacy, what is your first wish?
All right. My first wish, I already mentioned it, but to have the manning reflective of the demands of our system. So that would be first. Let's see. Second would be consistent on-time budgeting. So that way we can plan and implement those plans. And third would probably be for the people who do this mission. As you mentioned, a lot of times it's taken for granted, or the American public doesn't even know we still do this. It would be for every person who does this mission at the Missile Wings or at Kirtland, that they either know because people are telling them, or they have that internal reassurance and confidence that what they're doing is important and valued, and it provides the bedrock for everything else we do in the Department of Defense. If they could just know that and wake up knowing that every day, that would be amazing.
Yeah, those are three good wishes. Your second wish sort of spurred me for, you know, some of our listeners, we have a lot of listeners who are in the nuclear enterprise, so they probably know the answer. But for those that are not, because we're always trying to encourage those outside to take a peek inside through listening to NucleCast. But tell us why this, you know, the challenge of constant continuing resolutions, you know, uncertain budgets, what impact does that have on, you know, the missile force, the bomber force, you know, the rest of the operational military? How does that impact you?
It's from everything from, you know, when sometimes we do have the point where, oh, well, we didn't get a budget, so we've got to tell our civilians to go home for an indeterminate period of time. And we rely on those experts. Sometimes they're technical experts. Sometimes they're, you know, advisors, their leaders, and to send them home because a budget decision has not been made is very challenging. A lot of times it defers resources that we need. It defers, things very simple like professional development travels that now people cannot do or have to get rescheduled. So it has wide-ranging impacts across a lot of different aspects of our enterprise.
Yeah, it can make it hard to think long-term about what you need to acquire, how to plan long-term, stable budgets. And it's one of the things that's sort of unique to the federal government is that you're looking at annual budgets that are uncertain. Even then, it's not even once a year. So that's right. That's a fair point. So if you were to sort of have your elevator speech, you're walking off the stage, points to remember for the NucleCast audience, 6 months, a year from now, what do you want them to remember about 20th Air Force?
I'd want them to remember that we have amazing human beings that are currently operating, maintaining, and defending the most powerful weapon system on the planet. And they're doing it with professionalism and grace and knowledge and expertise and all of those things. They are doing it and they're young, they're motivated, they're proud. And if they get a chance to meet those people, you should feel comfortable asking them questions about what it is that they do. A lot of people think, oh, you probably can't talk about what you do. We can actually talk a lot about what we do, and we're super excited to do that. We love doing that. We love educating people on our mission because it's an incredible mission that we have been doing for a very, very long time.
All right. Major General Stacy Huser, 20th Air Force Commander, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, it's always great to talk to Stacy Huser. She's a super nice person, cares about her airmen and does a great job. So it's always good to talk to her, and she's always good to give us her time. And it's just, thinking through the mission of 20th Air Force and, how challenging it is to do it with a missile that was intended for 10 years and is now 50. That's always a challenge. So hopefully you enjoyed it as well.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence. Our executive producer is Kimberly Channington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.